Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 184. It's Monday, October 24th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID is still out there, although it's harder really to tell exactly in what way. Data has gotten a lot worse, and the local update is pretty much emaciated due to reporting either ending, that reporting being unreliable, or delayed reporting. But here we go. Here's a little bit of a situational analysis for COVID. Where are we at? Well, we have a soup of new souped-up COVID variants that are here and growing. Booster coverage is low and waning. There's only been 10% of eligible folks that have gotten the new bivalent booster, which is expected to give even better coverage than the previous boosters. And vulnerable populations like the elderly and immunocompromised are still getting slammed. We are at a low in deaths this year at under 400 per day, but this will only get worse as we get deeper into winter and flu season. So in the bonus article section at the end of the episodes that I usually do, I want to do just one quote to get at one of those vulnerabilities, and this is with the elderly. Although Americans over 65 remain the demographic most likely to have received the original series of vaccinations at 92%, their interest in keeping their vaccinations up to date is steadily declining, data from the CDC shows. To date, about 71% have received the first recommended booster, but only about 44% have received the second. Yet deaths in this age group doubled from April to July. Now, remember, this is only the second. I've actually gotten three boosters. And of course, that's the new bivalent booster, which is expected to be better. Okay, the thing that's kind of scary about this is that, so even to getting the second booster is only at 44%. And basically with boosters, now we're talking about a more recent shot. So with flu, you would normally get a shot every year. So with COVID, which is like a hyper flu, and with the variants evolving so fast, instead of getting it every year, you might need it every 6 months, or maybe even less, but say every 6 months, twice as much as the flu. We haven't seemed to have adapted to the idea that that's the reality that we're dealing with. So the elderly usually get way more than 50% coverage of flu shots, but we're not even seeing that with a new bivalent. Now, hopefully that'll go up as a fall, and particularly as cases start to rise, but it seems that we're not even treating COVID as seriously as we treat flu. Not good news. And one of the data points that we can get locally is active COVID cases in nursing homes. And compared to a couple weeks ago, it's gone up and we've hit a new high for, I think this is probably at least since the spring. We have 103 active cases in long-term care facilities in Lucas County, 68 residents and 35 staff. COVID is still alive and well among the vulnerable in our community. We can do better. Okay, well, let's get to a little bit more of COVID news and some other infectious disease news, as it seems infectious diseases are becoming more prominent in the landscape of public health today in the world and in America. First up for MedPage today, protection from older monovalent COVID vaccines is waning. A monovalent mRNA booster dose offered limited protection against COVID-related hospitalizations from the currently circulating Omicron variants, a CDC analysis found, likely due to the waning effects of the vaccines and potentially more immune evasion from the more recent BA4 and BA5 variants. In immunocompetent adults, vaccine effectiveness against hospitalization with three doses of mRNA vaccine, that's with one booster, dropped from 69% during the BA1 and BA2 period earlier this year to 31% during BA4 and BA5 this summer and fall. During the period of BA4 and BA5 specifically, protection against hospitalization declined from 60% in the first 4 months from the third dose to 29% thereafter. A second study showed similar declines for individuals with immunocompromising conditions during the period of Omicron predominance. Vaccine effectiveness against COVID-related hospitalizations with three doses was 67% during the earlier BA1 period in this population, but this fell to 32% during the later BA2 and BA2.1 and BA4 and BA5 circulation, and we're beyond those, getting even newer ones now. A fourth dose appeared to restore some of the protection in these immunocompromised individuals, upping the protection to 43% from the 32%. Of course, the new bivalent vaccines may do better. This is an older study because it takes a little while, takes a number of months to actually measure vaccine effectiveness. Okay, the final conclusion from these researchers. Research from both studies argued that the findings demonstrate the importance of staying up to date with COVID-19 vaccinations and suggested that the newer bivalent mRNA shots may offer superior protection, given that they target circulating BA4 and BA5 sublineages, as well as the ancestral strain of SARS-CoV-2. So get your booster. Okay, well, next up from Stat News, we're going to cover a story that gets at a vulnerable population, immunocompromised people. Biden officials search for backup for key COVID therapy for immunocompromised people. Biden health officials are bracing for the prospect that the country's sole preventative COVID-19 treatment for immunocompromised people would be ineffective this winter. AstraZeneca's Evusheld, the only monoclonal antibody authorized as a periodic injection to prevent infection, has become an essential shot for many of America's 7 million adults with weakened immune systems. But news this month that it is not effective against a steadily climbing coronavirus strain sent health officials racing to game out other antibody options and convene a meeting with patient groups. Top officials, including Health and Human Services Legal Counsel Stephen Cha and the FDA's Chief Medical Officer Hillary Marson, met with representatives from immunocompromised patients on October 4th, one day after the FDA quietly updated its Evusheld fact sheet to note that the antibody cocktail does not work against BA4.6, the strain that is already accounting for at least 13% of COVID-19 cases. Complicating the matter, the next potential monoclonal antibody, an Eli Lilly treatment, could be ready within 2 months, but it has already been shown ineffective against the other fast-rising variant, BAQ.1. The federal government has purchased 60,000 of these doses for uninsured and underinsured patients, according to two people familiar with the HHS monoclonal antibody planning. Evusheld is still effective against many variants, but it is not possible for physicians to know which strain a patient using it as a prophylaxis could be exposed to. Relatively few Americans are turning to monoclonal antibodies when they are sick with the virus. Instead, some are opting for the less expensive Paxlovid, a 5-day pill regimen. But the injections have become an important preventive measure for many people with cancer, recent organ transplants, and other immunodeficiencies that leave them more vulnerable to severe cases, particularly as most of the country returns to, quote, normal, taking off masks and convening at major events. But the FDA will have to walk a fine line when it comes to pulling Evusheld, particularly because no other options are currently available as a preventative injection. There is no set percentage of cases that would trigger a move. Two other antibody formulations, for instance, were pulled after a variant that evaded them made up approximately 3/4 of cases. Lilly and Regeneron options were yanked when 90% of new cases were Omicron-linked. Biden officials complain that they cannot motivate drug makers to pour money into development and manufacturing without additional COVID-19 funding from Congress. But congressional Republicans are actively opposing funding requests as they question how prior allotments were spent. Drug makers, meanwhile, are taking a bet on which treatments could be effective as the virus evolves and evades other options. While drug development is typically a gamble, making an effective monoclonal antibody for the fast-paced coronavirus has become increasingly high stakes. That's not just for the pharmaceutical companies, but for the individuals who are vulnerable. Okay, well, next up, some good news for vaccine access. This from CNBC. Uninsured kids will still receive COVID vaccines for free after shots move to commercial market. The CDC took a major step last Wednesday toward ensuring that kids who are uninsured can receive COVID-19 vaccines for free after the federal government shifts its immunization program to the commercial market. The CDC's independent advisors voted unanimously to include COVID shots authorized for kids by the FDA in the federal government's Vaccines for Children program. The Vaccines for Children program provides vaccines to kids under age 19 whose families cannot afford them. Children are eligible for the program if they qualify Medicaid or are uninsured, or Native American. Including COVID shots in the program does not make them a routine childhood vaccination for school, said Dr. Jose Romero, director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. The federal government has been providing COVID vaccines to everyone in the U.S. for free during the pandemic, but the Biden administration is working on a plan to transition the vaccine program to the commercial market as soon as 2023, which means people have to start paying for the shots themselves or through their insurers. The decision to include COVID shots in the free vaccine program will prove crucial to maintaining access for many children. As many as 5.3 million children are expected to lose health insurance through Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program whenever the Biden administration decides to end the COVID public health emergency. This is an access issue. This is an issue to allow children that don't have insurance to gain access to this vaccine, said Dr. Romero. And next up from MedPage Today, CDC adds COVID vaccination to recommended routine immunization schedule. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice voted unanimously last Thursday to add COVID-19 vaccination to its panel of routine immunizations for both kids and adults. The 15-0 vote does not mandate vaccination for children or adults or prevent unvaccinated children from attending school. It's simply an annual update to the adult and children immunization schedules. Responding to concerns raised in public comments about making COVID vaccines part of the routine childhood schedule, Dr. Matthew Daly, senior investigator for the Institute for Health Research at Kaiser Permanente, said the vote didn't reflect a new policy or a mandate. But I will acknowledge that there is symbolism in adding COVID-19 to the childhood immunization schedule, and that symbolism is that we view this as routine and that we view this as COVID is here to stay, Dr. Daly said. Next up from Medical Express, COVID-19 contributed to a quarter of maternal deaths from 2020 to 2021, report finds. COVID-19 contributed to a quarter of all U.S. maternal deaths last year and in 2020, according to an oversight report. The report from the U.S. Government Accountability Office, a nonpartisan government auditing agency, details maternal mortality disparities during the pandemic and how the coronavirus contributed to overall maternal deaths. Pregnant people are more vulnerable to adverse COVID-19 outcomes, and the CDC said, during the pandemic, maternal deaths saw a sharp rise and disparities widened. A staggering number of these deaths were preventable, according to the CDC. And next up, some interesting research about the earlier part of the pandemic and its potential health effects. This from the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Study says early state lockdowns not tied to worse mental health. New research from the American Psychological Association shows that various state restrictions and lockdowns imposed during the first 6 months of the pandemic were not related to worsening mental health. The study is published in Health Psychology. The survey contained questions about symptoms of distress, loneliness, and traumatic stress, both acute and post-traumatic stress, that respondents experienced in the prior week. Participants were also asked if they knew anyone with COVID-19 and how much news and social media they consumed about the pandemic. Though loneliness and symptoms of distress increased for participants during the first 6 months of the pandemic, those feelings were not related to state lockdowns and instead were correlated with knowing someone who had the virus and consuming a lot of pandemic-related media. There were robust significant relationships between personal direct experiences with the pandemic, that is, knowing someone who got very sick or died or getting sick oneself, and getting an increased global distress, loneliness, and traumatic stress symptoms, the authors concluded. Personal experiences may be more strongly and uniquely associated with psychological symptomatology than our state-level restrictions. First author Rebecca Thompson said, because a strong predictor of distress in our study was personal bereavement, knowing someone who has been very sick or died was far more stressful than the presence of state-level restrictions. Future waves of COVID-19 and other potential pandemics should be met by targeted interventions to prevent the loss of life. So, put more simply, it's the disease, not the response to the disease, that is causing problems. Well, folks, anti-vaccine perspectives are still contagious. This from Grid News. Divide between Republicans and Democrats over flu shots deepen in COVID's wake. An exclusive Harris Grid poll finds Democrats are twice as likely as Republicans to have gotten the flu shot this year. The partisan split on flu vaccine uptake has widened in the United States, widened as the United States braces for what could be its worst flu season since the COVID pandemic began. A third of U.S. adults have gotten a flu shot this fall, including 49% of Democrats and 22% of Republicans. Just over a quarter of adults do not plan to get the flu vaccine this year, the poll found, but that rises to 37% among Republicans. 30% of adults said they will get the shot, and 9% are unsure. Getting vaccinated against influenza did not used to be so polarizing, said Rupala Lemaye, a behavioral scientist at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. While rates of flu vaccination started slowly diverging along party lines several years before 2020, the Democrat-Republican split was 67-51 in 2019. The gap has only grown wider since the pandemic, reaching a 24-point difference in 2021. It's in line with what we're seeing in terms of COVID vaccine uptake, with far fewer Republicans getting the COVID vaccine, Lemaye said. COVID's impact showed up in the poll, with 18% of Republicans reporting that the pandemic has made them less likely to receive a flu vaccine each year, the poll found, compared with just 7% of Democrats. The forces driving this split are complex. To me, the issue here is not necessarily that people are anti-vaccine, Lemaye said. It's that people are trying to stay in line with their political ideologies. And for Republicans, vaccines have become a casualty of that. They see vaccines as a symbol of the government telling you what to do. That sentiment was around before COVID, but polarization around pandemic measures has only elevated vaccines as an emblem of political identity. Myths and disinformation about the safety and efficacy of COVID vaccines has also fueled that rise, says Adrian Casaletti, Chief of Government and Public Affairs at the National Association of County and City Health Officials. To see it play out here in the unrelated flu vaccine just so shows how much more work needs to be done to build back trust in vaccines overall, she said. The growing partisan divide could have worrying consequences for the flu season and those to come. Flu came roaring back in parts of the southern hemisphere after 2 years of relatively quiet seasons, potentially previewing a bad flu season in the U.S. this winter. Already there are signs that the influenza virus is getting an early start here. With another COVID surge looming, vaccination is the best way to keep hospitals from being overwhelmed. Many health systems are still understaffed as burned-out nurses and other healthcare workers leave the bedside. A dip in Republicans willing to get vaccinated lowers the overall influenza vaccination rate, which could increase hospitalizations and deaths. But given political sorting and where people live, the gap could put an extra strain on hospital systems in Republican-leaning communities. If this gap persists, vaccination programs, including school or workplace pop-ups, might shut down in some places. Translating a few years of lower uptake into more permanent reductions in access. The consequences of COVID vaccine polarization has proved significant, with lower uptake likely contributing to a 76% higher death rate among Republicans than Democrats since vaccines became available, according to a National Bureau of Economic Research analysis released last month. Flu is less deadly than COVID, but it still kills between 12 and 50,000 people each year. Lower vaccine uptake would worsen influenza's impact. Reversing this trend will prove challenging, Casaletti said. But local health departments can play a crucial role, ensuring broad and easy access to vaccines while relying on trusted community members to communicate the benefits of getting vaccinated will be crucial. But in an environment where leading politicians routinely take aim at basic public health measures, local officials are fighting an uphill battle, she said. When you actively try to dismantle trust in public health, the implications go far beyond COVID. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Well, it's not just Republicans who suffer disproportionately from flu. This from MedPage Today. Blacks suffer flu hospitalizations about 80% higher than whites. Influenza-associated hospitalization rates were nearly 80% higher among black adults compared with white adults from 2009 to 2010 compared to 2021 to 2022, according to a CDC's Vital Signs report. These rates were also 30% higher among American Indian Alaska Native adults and 20% higher among Hispanic adults compared to white adults. Furthermore, vaccination coverage for influenza has been consistently lower among black, Hispanic, and American Indian Alaska Native adults since 2010. During the 2021 to 22 flu season, vaccination coverage was lower among Hispanics at 38%, American Indian Alaska Natives at 41%, black at 42%, adults compared with coverage among whites at 54% and Asians at 54%. While the CDC recommends getting a flu vaccine every year, only about half of all Americans follow this advice. There are many reasons for disparities in vaccine uptake, including lack of access to healthcare and insurance, missed opportunities to vaccinate, and misinformation and distrust. According to CDC estimates, influenza has resulted in 9 to 41 million illnesses, 140,000 to 710,000 hospitalizations, and 12 to 52,000 deaths per year from 2010 to 2020. So you'll note that the actual incidence, the number of cases that happens for influenza is 9 to 41 million illnesses. Well, we had way more than 40 million COVID infections just over the summer, and we haven't even got to flu season yet. COVID-19 is not the flu. It's much more prevalent, meaning it's around much more, and each individual case is more serious. Okay, next up, let's go worldwide. This from Medical Express. World Health Organization says COVID-19 vaccination rates have dropped 50% in Africa. The number of COVID-19 vaccine doses given in Africa has dropped by more than 50% over the last 3 months, the WHO said, even though less than a quarter of all Africans have been vaccinated. Despite increased availability of vaccines on the continent, Africa still lags far behind the global average, with only 24% of the population having completed their primary series of COVID-19 vaccination, compared to 64% worldwide. The end of the COVID-19 pandemic is within sight, but as long as Africa lags far behind the rest of the world in reaching widespread protection, there is a dangerous gap which the virus can exploit to come roaring back, said Dr. Matshidiso Moeti, the WHO Regional Director for Africa. Once COVID-19 vaccines became available in 2021, Western countries hoarded available supplies, leaving many African countries last in line to receive doses. Some African countries also said that the doses donated by Western countries were sent too close to their expiration dates to be fully utilized. Africa now has adequate vaccines available. But as case numbers have fallen, so too has interest in being vaccinated. of over 4,000 new cases reported on the continent last week, this is only 1.3% of Africa's peak during December 2021, the WHO said. Unfortunately, as vaccines have helped avert serious COVID-19 illness, hospitalization, and death, people are less fearful and also less willing to get vaccinated. And back on the home front, this from The Hill, feds issue national biodefense strategy. The White House last Tuesday released its national biodefense strategy, outlining President Biden's plan to protect the U.S. from future pandemics and biological threats. The plan, which utilizes 20 federal agencies, aims to detect early warnings of pandemics and biological threats, prevent epidemics and biological incidences, and prepare to reduce the impacts of epidemics. Other goals, including rapidly responding to outbreaks, as well as restoring community, the economy, and the environment after a pandemic or biological incident. Additionally, the strategy lays out plans for moonshot efforts, such as transforming early warning of pathogens through next-generation technologies, launching diagnostics for any new pathogen within 12 hours of an outbreak, and developing novel vaccines within 100 days. Of course, the big unknown in this is funding. Republicans don't seem to be very interested in providing resources for such plans. And in other vaccine news, this from MedPage Today, chickenpox vaccine has proven highly effective, decreasing deaths by 97%. The odds of children becoming infected with chickenpox have decreased since universal vaccination was recommended in the U.S., with deaths also decreasing, research said. Within 10 years of initiating the vaccine program with one dose of the varicella vaccine in 1995, the incidence of chickenpox cases, hospitalizations, and deaths declined by 71 to 91% compared with the time before the vaccine was available, said Mona Marin of the CDC's National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. However, because limited transmission was still occurring in school settings, a two-dose schedule was initiated in 2007. But by 2019, cases decreased by over 97%, hospitalizations decreased by 94%, and deaths decreased by 97%. Among individuals under the age of 20, there was an even greater positive impact, with decreases of 99%, 97%, and 99%, respectively. Even people over 50 years of age saw a 97% reduction in deaths. Over the last 25 years, vaccination resulted in 91 million cases prevented, 238,000 hospitals averted, and approximately 2,000 deaths prevented. For chickenpox to go from an inevitability of childhood to being rarely seen in just one generation is truly remarkable. The significance of the vaccine program in lives saved, in sickness, and in hospitalizations avoided, and in prevention of disruption to schools and family life cannot be overstated. Children are not the only group to benefit. As more kids were vaccinated, chickenpox transmission decreased significantly in the general population. This shift helped protect the most vulnerable who could not receive the vaccine, immunocompromised individuals, pregnant individuals, and infants too young to be vaccinated. The United States was the first country in the world to implement a universal chickenpox vaccination program. The degree of control of the disease in the United States was unimaginable just 25 years ago, but picture that on a global scale. As science continues to advance, the chickenpox vaccine is a testament to the transformative power of public health. She estimated that the vaccine program has also saved the American public $23 billion since 1995. Well, that's a great story on how vaccines work, but of course you have to have vaccines for them to work, and they have to get them in people's arms. Next up from The Guardian, we see a story about a shortage. The World Health Organization is forced to ration vaccine as cholera cases surge worldwide. A dire shortage of cholera vaccines amid an unprecedented rise in global cases has forced health officials to halve the number of doses given to people in outbreak hotspots, the WHO has said. The exceptional decision to reduce the number of doses from 2 to 1 would allow for the vaccines to be eked out until the end of the year and given to more people in more countries. The organization conceded the move would inevitably lead to a reduction and shortening of immunity, adding the one-dose strategy has proven to be effective to respond to outbreaks, even though evidence on the exact duration of protection is limited, and protection appears to be much lower in children. Mike Ryan, the executive director of the WHO's Health Emergencies Program, said the decision marked a sad day. "We wouldn't have to do it," Ryan said, "and it is purely based on the availability globally of vaccines." 29 countries have reported cholera cases this year, including Haiti, Malawi, and Syria, which are facing large-scale outbreaks. Health officials believe the true number to be higher given some countries' reluctance to be associated with a heavily stigmatized, quote, disease of the poor. The tally shows a clear uptick on the previous 5 years, when fewer than 20 countries on average reported outbreaks. The WHO has said it is particularly concerned about the fatality rate, which this year was almost 3 times the rate of the past 5 years. Cholera is a waterborne disease and is easily treatable if responded to in a timely fashion, but it can kill within hours if not. The International Coordinating Group, the body that manages emergency stocks of vaccines, had taken the decision because of the extremely limited supply, reiterating previous calls for urgent action to boost global vaccine production. This scarcity will only be exacerbated by a key manufacturer decision revealed by The Guardian last week to discontinue production of one of the two oral cholera vaccines used in humanitarian emergencies. As vaccine manufacturers are producing at their maximum current capacity, there's no short-term solution to increase production. The temporary suspensions of the two-dose strategy will allow the remaining doses to be redirected for any needs for the rest of the year. And in more infectious disease news, this from Medical Express. As hepatitis C proliferates, states lift barriers to treatment. While national efforts to eliminate hepatitis C have faced setbacks because of increased drug use, the impact of COVID-19 and insurance complications, there is a bright spot. Some states are now making it easier for patients to treat the disease. Hepatitis C, a viral inflammation of the liver spread through blood and other bodily fluids that infects more than 2 million adults and contributes to 14,000 deaths annually, has increased in recent years, with the Infectious Diseases Society of America estimating the hepatitis C infections spiked 71% from 2014 through 2018. There is a cure for it. There's two direct-acting antiviral drugs that have been available for nearly a decade. The FDA approved these in December 2013 and 2014, and since then the FDA has approved other antivirals. Still, a high price tag and administrative hurdles to covering and prescribing the drug have complicated uptake. Without treatment, hepatitis C is a chronic condition that can lead to liver cancer or advanced liver disease and can even be fatal. But antivirals can cure a patient in 8 to 12 weeks and have been proven to be 95% successful curing hepatitis C. More recently, the CDC, from data from their August Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, showed that infections continued to rise between January 2017 and March 2020, especially among younger adults who use injectable drugs. That same report found that the number of people receiving treatment for hepatitis C is far below the trajectory needed to hit federal goals to eliminate viral transmission by 2030. The report found that treatment levels were highest in 2015 and lowest in 2020, varying by insurance status and age. Only 35% of individuals with private insurance get treatment within a year of diagnosis. That number drops to 28% for Medicare recipients and 23% for Medicaid beneficiaries. People shouldn't have to jump over hurdles to access life-saving, cost-effective treatment. Removing barriers to treatment is a critical step, as is increasing screening for hepatitis C. In Medicaid, treatment is lowest among recipients who are Black or identify as other race, and in states with restrictions on hepatitis C treatment. Recent events have created a perfect storm for hepatitis C to proliferate. The COVID-19 pandemic led to reduced screening and testing, thwarting momentum to eliminate hepatitis C. Drug abuse, commonly tied to hepatitis C outbreaks, also increased during the pandemic. These drugs both initially listed for more than $80,000 of treatment. The rollout of alternatives has helped to drop the price, though the specific cost can vary depending on the type of facility and the state, and if the state is using an innovative payment model. As the cost of treatment has come down as a result of things like competition and rebates, state Medicaid programs are more willing to remove these restrictions because they recognize that it's not going to bust their budget. States are slowly starting to roll back some of the barriers for treatment. 15 states and D.C. have removed their Medicaid prior authorization requirements. Of those, 6 states and D.C. implemented the changes this year. Prior authorization requirements, meaning a provider needs insurance company approval before administering treatment, can limit patients from qualifying or even seeking these drugs. Arkansas and South Dakota, for example, require patients to demonstrate liver damage to even qualify for antivirals. Other states have imposed requirements related to substance use or other restrictions. Health advocates say such restrictions are unfair to patients and ultimately more costly than addressing the symptoms of untreated hepatitis C. Caitlin Whaley, a Missouri Department of Social Services spokesman, said that Missouri's program saw a 23% increase in participants treated for hepatitis C in the first year after it removed prior authorization requirements. So this is very effective, albeit very expensive, to treat hepatitis C. Of course, the very costly cost-effective prevention would be to decrease injection drug use, particularly because this is related to infections. So you can either reduce injection drug use or do harm reduction techniques such as offering clean syringes so people are not sharing syringes and sharing infections. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Next up, a story on health disparities. It's from Medical Express. Mortality disparities by education widened in the U.S. in 2020. In 2020, there was an increase in mortality disparities by educational attainment in the United States, according to a study published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. The researchers found that for adults with the least versus the most education, all-cause death rates were about twofold higher, which persisted when excluding COVID-19 deaths. Patterns were similar for race, ethnicity, and sex. From 2007 to 2019, disparities in cause-specific mortality by education were generally stable, followed by a considerable increase in mortality disparities for heart disease, cancer, stroke, and unintentional injury from 2019 to 2020. The relative increase in rate ratio from 2019 to 2020 was greatest for unintentional injury among these causes of death, with a 25% increase. And another story that gets at inequalities and inequities, this from Medical Express. Robust Texas healthcare system does not produce better patient outcomes. Texas's healthcare industry is one of the most robust in the nation, but that hasn't translated to better outcomes for its citizens, according to a new report from Rice University's Institute for Public Policy. Texas has the most hospitals of any state, employs the second most healthcare workers nationwide, and has the third largest Medicaid budget, but it ranks in the bottom 10 in terms of overall system performance, according to a report from the Baker Institute Center for Health and Biosciences. The authors identify ways policymakers can prioritize public health over the next decade, such as increasing access to health insurance, investing in infrastructure, and transforming financing. Our state is one of extremes, a place where our medical facilities are pioneering care delivery, but our mothers are facing some of the highest maternal mortality rates in the country, a place where we lead in funding for translational research, but lag in support of our basic public health needs, the authors wrote. Compared with people from other states, Texans are more likely to report they're in poor health or go without care due to cost. They live in worse food environments, engage in less physical activity, and face greater transportation barriers. All of these issues are exacerbated for those with lower socioeconomic status and for people of color. Hurdles to access lead to worse outcomes. For example, preventable hospitalizations among adults and the 30-day mortality rate in Texas hospitals both increased significantly in recent years. And in another access story, this from USA Today, more than 1.3 million Americans ration life-saving insulin due to costs. That's, quote, very worrisome to doctors. More than 1.3 million American adults with diabetes skip doses, delayed buying, or otherwise rationed doses of insulin due to escalating costs of the life-saving medication, a new study found, published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. All people with type 1 and some with type 2 diabetes need the drug, but the price of versions of the drug nearly tripled from 2002 to 2013, and even more so in recent years. Okay, as I've reported in previous episodes a lot recently, Medicaid Advantage is a disaster. And fortunately, we're getting some pushback from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. This from MedPage Today. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services puts the kibosh on misleading Medicare Advantage sales pitches after reviewing thousands of complaints about confusing, misleading, and/or inaccurate Medicare Advantage ads and using secret shoppers to document deceptive telephone sales pitch. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services announced it is putting its foot down last Thursday. The agency is particularly concerned with recent national television advertisements promoting Medicaid Advantage plan benefits and cost savings, which may only be available in limited service areas or for limited groups of enrollees, overstate the available benefits, as well as use words and imagery that may confuse beneficiaries or cause them to believe the advertisement is coming directly from the government. The center is also reviewing recordings of agent and broker calls with potential enrollees and continuing its secret shopping of marketing events by reviewing television, print, and internet marketing and calling related phone numbers and or requesting information via online tools. Our secret shopping activities discovered that some agents were not complying with current regulation and unduly pressuring beneficiaries, as well as failing to provide accurate or enough information to assist a beneficiary in making an informed enrollment decision. One example of what is considered deceptive is any ad that tells targeted beneficiaries that they will get money back in their Social Security checks if they enroll in a Medicare Advantage plan. That claim applies to extremely limited number of people in certain zip codes. The people who are so-called agents or the call centers that receive calls from these ads have an expression, quote, turn them and burn them, meaning rapidly enrolling a beneficiary in a plan without spending the time to find out what their needs are. Many consumer groups have been complaining for years about misleading ads and claims like the one featuring Joe Namath. But what changed is that the pandemic allowed for special enrollment periods for COVID-infected individuals, and that allowed the ads to run year-round, so naturally complaints escalated. That got the attention of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Some plans may advertise that their extra benefits include rides to the doctor, dental coverage, hearing aids, and home meals. But after the beneficiary enrolls, they learn that only a small portion of those costs are covered, or they have to go to certain providers who aren't near their home, or that there are co-pays and deductibles. The center's letter is part of a wide-ranging effort by many federal agencies to crack down on the myriad of Medicare Advantage plan practices, including delays and denials of care through prior authorization requirements, and concerns that dozens of plans fraudulently inflate the severity of their illnesses, the enrollees' illnesses, to receive billions of dollars more from the Medicare Trust Fund that were not needed for their patient care. Yep, Medicare Advantages as a whole are a disaster. Buyer beware. Okay, well, in other enforcement news, this from CNN, EPA launches federal civil rights investigation over Jackson water crisis. The EPA has opened a federal civil rights investigation into the state of Mississippi over the Jackson water crisis. Last Thursday, in response to complaints filed by the NAACP and Jackson residents, the EPA announced it will investigate whether the Mississippi Department of Health and the Mississippi Department of Environmental Quality, quote, discriminated against the majority black population of the city of Jackson on the basis of race in the funding of water infrastructure and treatment programs and activities. An EPA spokesperson told CNN last Friday, should the EPA find wrongdoing, it has the power to withhold federal funds from the state of Mississippi, but would be careful not to deprive Jackson of funds needed to ensure safe and reliable drinking water. It was no invitation for polite chit-chat, as the highest law enforcement office in the land warned it was prepared to file a lawsuit under the federal Safe Drinking Water Act, which charges the EPA with setting and enforcing baseline health standards for tap water. All right, go EPA. Next up, let's go worldwide with Medical Express. Ongoing global crises have led to a big backslide in women's, children's, and adolescents' health. A new UN report shows that women and children's health have suffered globally as the impacts of conflict, the COVID-19 pandemic, and climate change converge with devastating effects on prospects for children, young people, and women. Data presented in the report show a critical regression across virtually every major measure of childhood well-being and many key indicators of sustainable development goals. Since the last Every Woman, Every Child Progress Report published in 2020, food insecurity, hunger, child marriage, risk from intimate partner violence, and adolescent depression and anxiety have all increased. An estimated 25 million children were un or under vaccinated in 2021, 6 million more than in 2019, increasing the risk of contracting deadly and debilitating diseases. Millions of children missed out on school during the pandemic, many for more than a year, while approximately 80% of children in 104 countries and territories experienced learning loss because of school closures. Since the start of the global pandemic, over 10 million children lost a parent or caregiver to COVID-19. At the core of our unkept promise is the failure to address the gaping inequities at the root of global crises, from the COVID-19 pandemic to conflicts and the climate emergency. The report describes the impacts of these crises on women, children, and adolescents, from maternal mortality to education losses to severe malnutrition. The report provides a wide-ranging evidence that children and adolescents face widely divergent chances of leading a healthy life simply based on where they were born, their exposure to conflict, and the economic circumstances of their families. For example, a child born in a low-income country has an average life expectancy at birth of around 63 years compared to 80 in high-income countries. More than 45 million children had acute malnutrition in 2020, a life-threatening condition which leaves them vulnerable to death, developmental delays, and disease. A staggering 149 million children were stunted in 2020. Africa is the only region where the numbers of children affected by stunting increased over the past 20 years. The six countries with the highest number of internally displaced persons, Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Ethiopia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, are also among the top 10 food insecure countries. A woman in sub-Saharan Africa has around 130 times higher risk of dying from causes related to pregnancy or childbirth than a woman in Europe or North America. In the face of increasing political pushback against sexual and reproductive health and rights in many countries, women, children, and adolescents today are left without many of the protections of just a decade ago, and many others still have not seen the progress they need. Access to sexual and reproductive health services, including contraception, is a fundamental right that directly and acutely affects the ability of women and adolescent girls to thrive. We need to expand these rights and services to the most marginalized, leaving no one behind. Next up, dovetailing with that story from Medical Express, sexual assault-related ER visits increased more than tenfold in the last decade. Emergency departments saw 15 times more sexual assault-related visits in the past decade, outpacing the growth of law enforcement reporting, according to research in JAMA Network Open. These findings demonstrate the role that healthcare providers can play in improving long-term medical and psychosocial health for these individuals. A new sexual assault is estimated to occur every 68 seconds in the U.S., with nationally reported rapes and sexual assaults increasing from 93,000 in 2006 to almost 140,000 in 2019, according to the FBI. Studies suggest that people who have experienced sexual assault are at greater risk for suicidal ideation, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, substance use, and chronic conditions more than their peers. However, historically, a small percentage of people seek medical care for sexual assault, as few as 1 in 5, according to some studies, and when they don't, it's often incomplete, and when they do, it's often incomplete or inadequate care. Potential factors behind the increase could include societal destigmatization of sexual assault, as well as changes in how emergency medicine providers code for it, and increasing prevalence of sexual assault in the U.S. And sticking with the theme of violence against women, this from Medical Express, homicide is a leading cause of death in pregnant women in the U.S. Women in the U.S. are more likely to be murdered during pregnancy or soon after childbirth than to die from the three leading obstetric causes of maternal death, that are high blood pressure disorders, hemorrhage, or sepsis, says experts at the British Medical Journal. Rebecca Long of Harvard School of Public Health and colleagues say the majority of these pregnancy-associated homicides are linked to the lethal combination of intimate partner violence and firearms, and are entirely preventable. They argue that ending male violence, including gun violence, could save the lives of hundreds of women and their unborn child in the U.S. every year, and is an urgent priority for the health and safety of women everywhere. Intimate partner violence is common worldwide, with 1 in 3 women reporting experience of violence, including physical, sexual, and psychological abuse by a partner in their lifetime. Reports suggest the U.S. has a higher prevalence of lifetime and past year intimate partner violence than other high-income countries, and homicides by an intimate partner in the U.S. are overwhelmingly committed using firearms. Recent estimates indicate that firearms were used in 68% of homicides around pregnancy between 2008 and 2019. With black women at substantially higher risk of being killed than white or Hispanic women. Rates of domestic homicides are also associated with state-level rates of gun ownership and firearms legislation. Yet the authors note that few perpetrators of intimate partner violence are ever convicted, and many loopholes allowing access to firearms remain. The recent dismantling of reproductive rights in the U.S. brings further urgency to these issues. For instance, reproductive coercion, a common aspect of intimate partner violence, increases the risk of unintended pregnancy, while restricting access to abortion endangers women as unwanted pregnancies potentially amplify risks in abusive relationships. The researchers point out that pregnancy typically increases women's interactions with healthcare providers, presenting opportunities for screening, and other approaches to help women experiencing or at risk of violence. Such interventions may help stop a pattern of abuse that could lead to homicide or adverse health outcomes, they say. But these efforts must sit alongside urgent work to reduce all forms of violence against women. Amen. And next up from Reuters, hair straightening products linked with uterine cancer risk. Hair straightening products may significantly increase the risk of developing uterine cancer among those who use them frequently, a large study published suggests. We estimate that 1.6% of women who never use hair straighteners would go on to develop uterine cancer by the age of 70. But for frequent users, that risk goes up to 4.1%, said study leader Alexandra White of the U.S. National Institute of Environmental Health Safety. After accounting for participants' other health risk factors, the odds of developing uterine cancer were more than 2.5 times higher for women who had used straightening products more than 4 times in the previous year. Earlier studies have shown that hair straighteners contain so-called endocrine-disrupting chemicals. The products have previously been associated with higher risks of breast and ovarian cancer. And in a little bit better news for women, this from Medical Express. Study shows certain foods reduce hot flashes associated with menopause by 88%. A new study published by the North American Menopause Society in the journal Menopause found that a diet intervention is about as effective, 88%, as hormone replacement therapy, which ranges from 70-90% effectiveness for reducing menopausal hot flashes without the associated health risks. The women's study for the alleviation of vasomotor symptoms found that a plant-based diet rich in soy reduced moderate to severe hot flashes by 88% and helped women lose on average 8 pounds in 12 weeks. We do not fully understand yet why this combination works, but it seems that these three elements are key: avoiding animal products, reducing fat, and adding a serving of soybeans, explains lead researcher Neil Barnard, president of the Physicians Committee, an adjunct professor at the George Washington University School of Medicine. Our results mirror the diets in places in the world like pre-Westernized Japan and the modern-day Yucatan Peninsula, which are low-fat, plant-based diets, including soybeans, and where pre-menopausal women experience fewer symptoms. These new results suggest that a diet change could be considered as a first-line treatment for troublesome vasomotor symptoms, including night sweats and hot flashes, explains Dr. Barnard. This study demonstrates the effectiveness of a dietary intervention for menopausal symptoms. As well, it is precisely the diet that would be expected to reduce the health concerns of many women reaching menopause, an increasing risk of heart disease, breast cancer, and memory problems. Yet more evidence that a low-fat, plant-based diet is good for you. Okay, well, that brings us to the closing sex segment. Bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use, and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. 14 bonus articles this week. First up, the COVID data that are actually useful now. As I mentioned earlier in the show, much of it's disappearing. This might be helpful if you're still trying to figure this out. 2, milder COVID cases, lower viral loads in vaccinated frontline workers. So vaccines work. It may not prevent an infection, but it'll give you a milder case and give you lower viral loads, which means you're probably less likely to transmit it to somebody else. Good for public health. 3, among seniors, a declining interest in boosters. So this is a story I quoted from at the beginning of the show, and it seems that declining interest in boosters among seniors is relatively strong. Hopefully we've bottomed out at that 44% of seniors that are willing to get an additional booster, but hopefully we can improve that. Unfortunately, I think what may improve it is when COVID starts to rise here in the coming months. Bonus article 4, the very real lessons America has learned from COVID and the very real lessons it has not learned. Good background article. 5, how racism and inequality created COVID-19's viral underclass. How science won the battle against disease while racism and capitalism have won the war. Again, another great story and backgrounder on the grooves of public health. 6, to learn lessons from pandemics, don't listen to Big Pharma. This might be the big duh story of the day. Big Pharma failed, and with COVID vaccines worldwide, they failed big time, got in the way. Again, they might have provided some of the science, but racism and capitalism have won the war. Number 7, another kind of historical piece. If you reported this a lot in previous years, Trump officials interfered with CDC guidance for political purposes, panel finds. So if you want to revisit that. 8, covert network provides pills for thousands of abortions in U.S. post Roe. Woohoo! So this is a great article talking about kind of the underground network that's basically bringing these abortion pills in from Mexico. And they estimate that they've probably covered at least 20% of the abortions that have happened in the states with limitations since they've been starting to do this network. So they're really making a dent. Great news. 9, after Dobbs, U.S. medical students head abroad for abortion training no longer provided by their schools. So we've disabled our medical schools by criminalizing abortion in so many states. So there isn't enough places to get trained in the U.S., so they're going abroad. Article 10, the U.S. never banned asbestos. These workers are paying the price. So asbestos is largely banned in most places, but we've never completely banned it, and there are certain workers that are getting the terrible effects of asbestos. And more environment news, 11, alleging continual pollution, advocates ask U.S. EPA to take over Ohio injection well permitting. So I've reported this, that Ohio is one of the dirty states, and particularly these fracking wells are having a problem. So we need to change that permitting and get more accountability. Article 12, new guidelines greatly expand eligibility for weight loss surgery. So this bariatric surgery has become a lot more safer, and it's pretty effective. But they've really expanded this. The guidelines hadn't been updated since 1991, and there's been a lot of progress since then. But the kind of interesting thing is that it basically means that probably over 40% of Americans are eligible for this weight loss surgery. It's kind of an interesting thing that, you know, surgical approach would be the solution for so many people. And Article 13, speaking of wanting a surgical approach to fix something, trying to hold food corporations accountable has not worked well. So this is just kind of a summary in recent years that there's been a lot of pledges by food corporations and they're not panning out. Self-regulation doesn't work that well, especially in a capitalistic system. And last but not least, Article 14, pixels are not people. Mental health apps are increasingly popular, but human connection is still key. This is true for so many mental health issues. We need to make powerful human connections. Let us make it so. You can view these articles at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-